Welcome to Radio Sefarad's English Corner. I'm your host, Linda Jimenez, bringing news and other features of Jewish interest to Radio Sefarad's English-speaking audience in Spain and around the world. Our trivia question for this week is, what are some symbols that conversos etched on their houses as a way of communicating with other crypto-Jews? Jeannie Milgram was born in Havana, Cuba, into a practicing Roman Catholic family of Spanish ancestry. From a young age, she felt unusually attracted to Judaism. After going through a formal conversion, she began to research her family's history and was able to document her unbroken maternal lineage going back 6 centuries to pre-Inquisition Spain and Portugal, proving that she is, in fact, a descendant of forced converts. Her research led her to write the books My 15 Grandmothers and How I Found My 15 Grandmothers, A Step-by-Step Guide. The books were both winners of the 2015 Latino Author Book Awards. Jeannie has traveled extensively to Fermoselle, the village of her ancestors in the Zamora region of Spain, while doing field research on the town's Jewish past. Her new book, Pyre to Fire, is a captivating historical novel that juxtaposes the story of a Jewish family living in Fermoselle at the time of the Inquisition and her own fascinating autobiography.
Thank you very much for speaking with us today, Jeannie.
It's a pleasure to be here, Linda. It always is.
Well, thank you. I'm glad. It's always a pleasure to have you, too. You wrote of your own research into your own background in your first book, My 15 Grandmothers, which I highly recommend to our listeners because it makes for fascinating reading. But Pyre to Fire is different because it's historical fiction. Could you briefly tell us what it's about and what prompted you to write it?
Absolutely. So after I completed all the research from my family, I found that I had been going and pouring through hundreds, if not thousands, of records, whether they were birth certificates, death, last wills and testaments, and Inquisition records. And I, not only did I compile the actual genealogy, I was able to compile historical information on the family, like where the family went, where they moved from this little village to that little village. And so I found myself with all of this information, and I decided that, you know, perhaps I could compile it and put it together. So I started trying to do it in a nonfiction sort of way, but it was a bit dry because information that comes from records and a marriage record or this kind of record, it's a bit dry. So that's when I decided to do the historical fiction and, let's say, dress it up a little bit with what was going on Inquisition and directly after the Inquisition at the time. And then I was able to go back and forth to this little girl, me, in Miami, every time that I read something that had happened in 1492 or the 1500s that affected me later. So that's how the beginning of the book started.
Yeah, I think it's very interesting the way it jumps back and forth in time. And it's very clear because it's a different kind of print in the book. And how you kind of create parallel lives between that time, the medieval Spain, and nowadays and the present.
Correct. And it was an interesting form, an interesting writing style. And I have to tell you that when I first started writing in this style, I you know, talked to people that were, let's say, professional writers and in the industry, and they told me that generally this doesn't work, that it's very difficult to go back and forth unless you've been doing it a long time. I think I was able to do it effectively, but I didn't want to not have how it affected me in Miami. So even though it's historical fiction, I would say that its embellishment is only 15%, and 85% is the actual story of the family.
Have you written fiction before, or was this the first time that you actually wrote fiction?
This is my first fiction.
Wow, because I think you also were very effective in the way you did it. The part of the story that takes place in the 15th century takes place in Fermoselle, which is a border town between Spain and Portugal, and it's the home of your own ancestors. And the epilogue says that you reconstructed the medieval past of your family. You briefly mentioned that you had done research. How did you do the research and where, or was it research that you had previously done?
Well, Fermoselle belonged to the bigger region in Spain known as the Zamora region, which, if you're familiar with Spain, it's a little bit to the north of the river Duero or Douro, depending which side you're on, that's creating the natural boundary between Spain and Portugal. So a little bit to the north of that is Zamora, and Zamora is the one that's holding all of the, let's say, records, all of the birth certificates and death certificates. So the research had to be done in Zamora with the original documentation. And then Fermoselle itself as a village, they explained to me that every 100 years they passed their records over to Zamora. So the research was done at the parochial, archive, and it was done at the church archives and at the city archives as far as death, marriage, baptism, because obviously as Catholics for so many years, they were baptized. And then the other records were coming from Madrid, where you have land sales, last wills and testaments. All of these kind of, state records were coming from Madrid. So it was a mixture where I was able to pinpoint on a map where the family had lived, and even more than that, I was able to put together where the Jewish families lived.
Something I would like to ask you about also is how much of what is in the book is fact and how much is fiction. And I imagine that the characters in the book are fictional characters that are based on the situation that was going on at the time. But I want to ask you, first tell me that, and then I'll ask you about particular incidents in the book and whether they were completely fact or whether they were fictionalized.
Okay, so the book is 85% fact, 15% fiction. What was factual in the book is where the characters were born, what they did for a living, where they moved from place to place, and how they fit into a particular community, and perhaps how they got to that particular community, whether it was by walking or crossing the river. All of that is fact. As a matter of fact, recently in Zamora, I took the opportunity to leave the conference for a few minutes, and I went down to the base of the river Duero, and I actually took pictures of a section that had the trees that I had envisioned and the rocks where I had done the fictional death of a family. So it was very moving for me to be actually there. And even though I wrote about it before I saw it, when I saw it, it just flipped me out of my mind. So 85%, I would say, is correct, and the other is fiction. And the characters, you asked about the characters. So the Jewish names, obviously, we didn't have. I never was able to find a Jewish name. So, the mother of the main character, Rina, this is a Jewish name. So these characters are fictional. The real character is Catalina. Now, in my family tree, starting in like 1405 and let's say spanning to maybe 1600, I had over 100 Catalinas, the actual name Catalina. One grandmother would die, and the other one would be named Catalina, and the other one would be named Catalina. This is why I chose Catalina to be the initial character, because that was the actual names that I found in my own tree.
There are some things that take place in the book that I think are surprising, or would be surprising to someone who's reading the book, and then they might say, hey, you know, could that really have happened? And so I'm going to ask you about them, okay? For example,
sure.
The elders getting together and they plan the conversion of the whole town because they hear the Inquisition is going to come, and so they decide that the whole town should convert, and they're going to hide all the Jewish things that they have, the Torahs and the artifacts, everything, in tunnels under the town. Could you explain that?
I will, and it's interesting that you picked up on that one point, and I'll tell you why. I started writing this book about 20 years ago. I started writing this book before I wrote my first book, before I started speaking, before I did absolutely anything, and before I fully knew Jewish history at the time, because I kind of came into this green. You know, anybody that has followed my story pretty much knows that I've been a businesswoman all my life, and I fell into this researching my own genealogy and then kind of became an expert on that area of the Inquisition. So I wrote this book, and the name of the book originally was Who Will Sit Shiva for Me? And it was a very poignant book, and I talked about the whole village converting. And when I showed it to my husband, who has had rabbinical learning and has attended yeshivas and is very learned in Jewish history, he told me, "You're nuts. You can't put that out there, because no Jew would ever convert the whole village, and it would never happen, and that's ridiculous." So he made me, like, doubt myself, because I was not a Jewish historian, and I didn't know enough about it. I had just had this fictional idea. So I put the book aside, and I had gotten way through it. I mean, really way through it, and I thought it was a great book. And so I got to the point where they were hiding things and making these tunnels, and I put it aside. So as my own history developed, I started learning about, for example, the Rabbi Solomon Halevi, who in the town of, I believe it was in Burgos, he was from Burgos, how he was a great and learned rabbi, and he had his whole town convert because he sold his rabbiship, whatever you want to call it, for being the Bishop of Santa Maria, changed his name willingly from Solomon Halevi to Bishop Archbishop Santa Maria. And all of the town pretty much went along with him, and they all converted. And nobody, it wasn't like at a moment that they had the sword to their necks. His wife absolutely did not agree with this. She left him. And like this, I started reading historically several other stories of towns that had decided to just convert and not have the sword on top of them, mostly earlier on, like in the 1300s, when you had the most conversions. So it no longer was something that couldn't happen. It no longer was a fantasy. And I picked up the book again, and I continued with it, and hence the book that you have. So I was, you know, I had stopped, because how could it be? Not by me, but how could it be from my husband? But it was just something that I later learned. Not only how can it be, it was, and it was in a big way.
Enfermoseye.
No. Enfermoseye, that part's fictional, because I set the book Enfermoseye, but it was happening around Spain.
But Enfermoseye does have tunnels under the town.
Oh, absolutely, which is what led me to do this Enfermoseye, is completely covered with tunnels from one end to the other. They're very impressive. So obviously the fact that they are physically there and dug out of the granite and it's connecting one home to the other, then of course this is exactly what would have happened if this fictional account was correct.
And in those tunnels, there are vestiges of Jewish practices, let's say.
Aren't there? Not really. You'd have to dig deep. I mean, we have found two mikvahs in the town of Hermosilla, which is a lot, like a public one and one in what we knew was a synagogue. But basically, I have not, let's say, gone through these tunnels on my belly, which is what it would require. I know that the main location that was known as a synagogue has a shelf that could have been used as an Aron Kodesh, and it has a back entrance and some, like, let's say, rock formations that could have been benches. But I have not seen actual vestiges, and I think that all those were erased. But then again, I would have to spend a few days in Ben Hosea with flashlights and light going in and out of these tunnels, because they go on and on and on. They're under every house, is joined underground by a tunnel.
You talk about certain symbols that the conversos etched in the stone of their houses as a way of communicating with other crypto-Jews. Can you tell us about them?
Yes, these are mostly crosses that have some sort of symbolism to Judaism. For example, it'll be a cross that will have a shin, the Hebrew letter shin on the top. Or you will find a cross, and it's sitting on top of a backwards shin on the bottom. So you will also find crosses that are sitting like on top of 12 little stones that historians have now said that's like symbolizing the 12 tribes of Israel. Or you find crosses that are on top of steps, like the steps of Zion. And you'll find crosses that have anchors drawn around the bottom of the cross, or it'll end in an anchor. And a lot of these crosses you see at mezuzah height at the entrance of the churches, and they're worn. They're like butter soft. And in Fermoseye, on the back door, there is such a cross with a circle and an anchor at the bottom. And nowadays, everyone has, let's say, the Red de Juderías that are responsible for preserving Jewish marks are now putting signs around the villages in Spain and Portugal marking these, let's say, crypto crosses.
And do they know what they were for, why they did that?
You know, we've had to take most of our information. We've had to take it at face value. And I know that a lot of the academics and a lot of the people that study this, they want proof positive. But you can't really have proof positive of a people that ceased to exist and lived by hiding. All we know is that these marks are there. They're all over the place. In Fermoseya, there's a cross on the side of one of the chapels that's like it's cut through by the Inquisition sword. The cross is on top of 12 little balls, like the 12 tribes of Israel. And on the top, there's a semi-like menorah, and it says Yod-Heh, Vav-Heh, the name of God in Hebrew. And in Zamora, at the entrance of the Church of Ildefonso, right in the foyer, let's say, tiny little foyer, towards the floor, you can see etched a menorah. So, yes, they were not as open in Fermoseya actually putting a menorah that was way out there, but they had symbols in these crosses.
You also give a description of crypto-Jewish life. Could you give us some examples of some of the things they did, like how they continued to celebrate their holidays, for example?
This became very difficult for the crypto-Jews. They had to be hiding all the time, and they had notebooks. And they would generally, from historians that have written about this, they would generally only tell their children when the children became bar mitzvah age. So the children would not really know that they were anything but Catholic, and so they pretended to an incredible extent. So, for example, they could not fast on Yom Kippur openly. Fasting was one of the things that was actually kept a lot because it's very personal. But everyone was being watched by servants and this and that. So, for example, Yom Kippur, they would make these big empanadas that were with meat and I actually have that recipe with meat and eggs and, you know, very artisan empanada, huge. And they would pick up their picnic baskets and carry them out into the fields. Everybody in the town thought they were going on a picnic, and they would go out there and they would fast. And at the end of the fast, they would eat this empanada. Or, for example, they would make, I also have the recipe of some pork chops that are really made out of bread. They're fashioned and shaped like pork chops and fried. And so they would eat these and at the same time throw a pork chop in the fire so the house would make a smell of ham. Mm. So this is the kind of thing that culturally they had to do. Whenever there was a wedding, they would, the night before, they would have the girl go to the mikvah secretly. And then they would try to meet in a house, and they would be married to each other by consecrated by the laws of Moses and in the typical way. And the next day they would go to the church. So there was a lot of this going on to be able to survive. After a while, they could no longer even pretend to fast on Yom Kippur. So they started observing the fast of Esther on Purim. And they called her Saint Esther. There was never a Saint Esther. So to this day, they still, the Catholic Church still has this Saint Esther running around that came, that the people were fasting for Saint Esther. And it was really Esther from the story of Purim.
Do the people in Fermoselle and other towns still do some of these things, still celebrate some of these holidays?
Well, for example, the mayor of Fermoselle allowed me to come in and talk to the people about their past. And all I had was Sunday. And I said to the mayor, listen, I can only do this. It was in a big auditorium they have. And I said to him, I can only do this Sunday, but I assume that Sunday everybody's going to church. And he said, no one goes to church here. I mean, the church is empty on every Sunday. They only go on holidays. So I found that odd, that in the middle of Spain, in a small village, that people aren't going to church. But as far as all of these other customs, I know that my grandmother taught me to check for blood in the eggs and a lot of other cooking kind of customs. And I have not really inquired. All I know is that they don't go to church.
Tell us about the digitizing project.
The digitizing project came about from my own difficulty in trying to find the Inquisition documents that are still in the original boxes, in archives, in Spain, in Portugal, Mexico City, Canary Islands. It's just this incredible amount of Inquisition judgments where we find our history, where we would know about our diaspora. So I got together a whole manual and a project. I contacted an organization that's educational and historical in Israel, the IIJG, and they are the International Institute of Jewish Genealogy, and they reviewed it, and I got, let's say, the stamp of approval on what I planned to do. And then I went in Israel and I partnered up with the company, the genealogy company, MyHeritage, who agreed to help me out and do some of this digitizing. So it's been 2 to 3 years running around to the archives in Lisbon, Madrid, Canary Islands, Mexico, Lima, Peru, And with some of the archives, we're already in contracting stage. With other of the archives, we're still hitting our head against the wall. So we are definitely looking for a way to get this done and get everything up on the internet so that people can look for their own history.
Are you still looking for funding, or is that taken care of?
The funding is taken care of, and I believe that the funding for the restoration of the archives in Lisbon is also taken care of.
Do you have any idea of when the project might be finished?
The only contract... No, let's change that. When will the project start? It takes years to get this off the ground, but I do believe that by next year, 2019, middle of next year, we should already be doing something positive in Madrid and in Mexico City.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Jeannie.
It was my pleasure.
That's it for this week. As always, we'd love to hear from you, so please email us any comments or suggestions or questions you'd like us to answer on the air. Our address is EnglishCorner@RadioSephirah.com. See you next week.